to some great rocking grooves by Pudge, The Red Handed, and my band Triple J, all in support of the Gananoque and Area Food Bank. Advance tickets are available now for $20 through Eventbrite or by emailing me at ganspringrock@gmail.com. You can also help by buying one of our incredible Gan Rocks 2026 t-shirts and participating in our fundraising auction on Facebook, featuring wonderful gifts from local businesses, all in support of a great cause. So, take a look on Facebook for Gan Rocks, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at Ganspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th.
Attention Ontario pickleball players. The Maple Leaf Pickleball Club invites you to the Smash for a Cause charity tournament in support of Jumpstart Charities. This action-packed day of competition and community spirit takes place at the Fairgrounds Racquet Club in Hamilton, Ontario, Sunday, April 26th. Whether you're playing for fun or for the podium, there are prizes to be won. And don't miss the battle for the coveted Maple Leaf Cup. Smash for a Cause. Register now at MapleLeafPickleball.org. That's MapleLeafPickleball.org.
Hi, this is Jill Barber, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, Iran's solidarity with Palestine. An Iranian legal scholar explains why Iran supports Palestinian liberation.
The relationship has never been a proxy relationship, and that's what they fail to understand. Iran has empowered through both the principles of the revolution, but also materially providing the capacity and the knowledge, the indigenous knowledge that it has produced, for them to then develop their own capacity to advance liberation movements, anti-colonial liberation movements in the region. Unless we have a region free from Zionist colonial occupation, none of us in the region are safe.
We also hear about how Palestinian women face abuse at the hands of the Israeli military, and how Israel is committing its largest land grab since the Nakba. This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our podcast on March 28th and our live stream broadcast on April 16th, 2026. Later in the show, the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima speaks with Helia Dutaghi, an Iranian scholar of international law and political economy at the University of Tehran. She was expelled from Yale last year amid a broader government crackdown on Palestine solidarity. She offers a view of the war that sharply contradicts Western narratives, one defined not by internal division or collapse, but by solidarity, political clarity, and a deepening sense of shared struggle across the region, above all, with Palestine. But first, bombed, wounded, used as human shields, and humiliated, what Israeli soldiers have done to women in Gaza. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Women Recount Abuse at Hands of Israeli Military by Ohud Nassar, writing from Gaza. Nassar profiles two women, Sharifa Kudih and Saja Abdel-Al, who, she says, reveal some of what women have endured during Israeli military incursions into Gaza's neighborhoods, a trajectory that begins but does not end with airstrikes and displacement. In a narrow corridor inside a government school that has been converted into a shelter in the city of Khan Yunus in Gaza's south, Sharifa Kudih, 50, sits on a piece of cardboard while families pass endlessly around her. Unmarried and with no children to care for, this corridor is all that remains, she said, after her home in the town of Abasan al-Kabira, east of Khan Yunus, was destroyed. In February 2024, Sharifa said, around 5:30 a.m., she was asleep in her home when it was bombed. I woke up to a massive explosion and then found myself under the rubble, she said. She was not badly injured, but was trapped beneath the debris for nearly 2 hours before invading Israeli troops heard her and pulled her out. "When they took me out, I thought I was going to die or be taken prisoner," she said. Instead, she told the Electronic Intifada, the soldiers ordered her to remove her hijab, the scarf covering her hair, and tied her hands. Then they questioned her. They asked me why I was in the house and about names of people. I didn't know any of them. Soldiers sat her on a chair on her own devastated land as they continued their operations. Sharifa said the soldiers then used her as a human shield alongside a group of young men. They forced us to walk in front of them, she said. Human rights organizations have documented hundreds of cases in which the Israeli military broke international law, including using women and children as human shields. Photos were taken of Sharifa while she was seated on a chair on a mound of earth with Israeli soldiers crouching behind her, apparently combat ready. She only discovered this later when an Israeli soldier received an award for the photo, which was apparently taken by drone, and said she gave no consent and was not asked for any. I was shocked when acquaintances sent me a photo of myself displayed in a gallery in Tel Aviv. I had no idea they had photographed me. After the soldiers finished with her, they let her go, a surveillance drone monitoring her from above, she said. She had to walk over rubble for more than an hour to get away from the area and to safety. Sharifa now lives in the corridor of the government school in Khan Yunis. She has neither a mattress nor a blanket. She sleeps like she sits on a piece of cardboard that was distributed as humanitarian aid. Her home was completely destroyed and she has nowhere else to go. Those are excerpts from Women Recount Abuse at Hands of Israeli Military by Ahud Nassar, a journalist and teacher writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. We now turn to another article we recently published on the Electronic Intifada. My colleague Tamara Nassar reports that Israel is establishing facts on the ground in the occupied West Bank faster than ever before. This excerpt is from her article, Israel's Largest Land Grab Since the Nakba. She writes that, quote, in March, Israel's so-called security cabinet covertly approved the establishment of 34 new settlements, not units, entire settlements in the West Bank. News of this decision only became public last week after being kept confidential by the cabinet when it was approved, reportedly in an effort to avoid backlash from the United States during negotiations for a ceasefire with Iran. This is Israel's largest ever colonial expansion, said Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, on April 9th. This is the largest ethnic cleansing and land grab in Palestine since the Nakba. It's happening under our watch, she continued. Tamara notes that before the current government took power in 2022, there were 127 recognized Israeli settlements in the West Bank, according to the Israeli group Peace Now, which monitors settlement activity. The newly approved 34 settlements would add to 68 that the government has already advanced since its formation, bringing the total number of settlements approved under this administration to 102, Peace Now added. This is roughly an 80% increase of all settlements in the West Bank advanced under this government alone. These developments are taking place against a backdrop of accelerating settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank, Tamara writes. At least 37 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far in 2026, at least 10 of them by settlers. Tamara adds that, quote, whether through de facto or de jure annexation, the Israeli objective has always been the same. The underlying logic of Zionism, as it is with any colonial movement, is the expansion of settlements and the displacement of the indigenous population to replace them with colonial settlers. Every Israeli front, whether in Gaza, the West Bank, or elsewhere, is ultimately rooted in that objective, Tamara writes. For much more, read Tamara Nassar's report, Israel's Largest Land Grab Since the Nakba, on electronicintifada.net. And now the Electronic Intifada's Executive Director, Ali Abunima, takes us to Tehran to speak with our next guest. This interview was recorded on March 28th, during the fourth week of the U.S.-Israeli war of aggression against Iran.
Dr. Helia Dutari is a scholar of international law and political economy whose work examines sanctions, post-colonial theory, and U.S. power. She was fired from the Yale Law School last year for her advocacy for Palestinian liberation and is now a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Tehran, where she is completing a book on neoliberalism and the sanctions regime targeting Iran. Since the start of the war, she has been documenting the experiences of ordinary Iranians and sharing them on social media. She joins us now. Dr. Helia, welcome to the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you so much for having me, Ali.
You recently attended a memorial event in Tehran for more than 160 schoolgirls murdered in a U.S. strike on the Shajareh Tayyibeh Elementary School in Minab in southern Iran. That attack on February 28th was on the first day of this war. At the memorial event, you spoke to some Tehran school children. Let's watch a clip of that together.
On February 28th, 165 children aged 7 to 12 were killed in a targeted U.S. strike in Shajareh Tayyibeh school in Iran. Today, people gathered to honor their memories. I spoke with children who could have been among Minab's students about the lessons they were learning before the U.S. carried out the attacks, their goals and their ambitions, and how they feel when they hear explosions.
Dr. Helia, after hearing these children speak with such hope and solidarity, even in the middle of war, and given your own experiences over the last few weeks, what can you tell us about how ordinary Iranians are coping right now, especially as daily life, schooling, and basic routines have been so deeply disrupted?
One thing that's been ongoing, and it's been incredible for me personally even to watch it unfold, has been the sustained and very strong presence of millions of Iranians all across the country every night to show support for Iran's positions, its military forces, but also I see it as practicing agency, even though not everyone is active and like fighting, but it's a form of resistance in a sense that they feel like they're protecting the country from any attempted coup like the one we saw in January. They're protecting the streets, they're protecting the revolution, and they're visible, active supporters of defending the sovereignty of Iran. And I think this is key in how Iran has been able to project its force outside of its borders, because unless and until Iran is able to sustain and have a strong sovereignty inside that relies on its popular revolution, that relies on its people, it would be unable to project and resist such force outside to protect itself. So I think that's been key. But that's not the whole story. There are other segments in Iranian society that are not necessarily on the streets every night. They don't feel like that's the way that they want to show support or participate or even are sympathetic to it, in a sense that they don't see them represented in that. What I mean is that I've seen people who are resisting, and maybe I will characterize it as quiet resilience, you know, those who are sustaining everyday life, and they believe that's how they're participating in this life. They maintain normalcy as much as one can, you know. They keep their shops open. They go to work. They bake breads. They clean the streets. It's sustaining the essential services, or not even on the essential services, but just to keep the look of our city still alive, still ongoing. It has been another form of resistance beyond the streets and beyond the rallies that have been happening on a daily basis. And yet another, you know, there are millions of students who no longer, as we saw, no longer go to school. Teachers, you know, workers, students, they've all been disrupted in a way that completely like takes the normalcy away. And how the state has been compensating for that, and I think that's been really brilliant, is coupled with internet shutdown and lack of access to education. The state has introduced free educational programming on national television covering grades 1 to 12. There has been free education essentially being provided to that has been helping a lot of parents to, you know, handle kids inside, because it's been very hard to keep the kids inside. Private platforms, you know, the Iranian version of Netflix, if you will, different streaming services, they have made educational content freely available or heavily discounted to make it accessible to many. And I've seen a lot of people who are, you know, maintaining learning and providing the structures for doing so online and otherwise, upping their skills, trying to be involved in different community supports, cooking for the volunteers who show up to support anyone who's been harmed, showing up to the iftar during Ramadan. It's been incredible how people gather together to have iftar in mosques and elsewhere. It's been a beautiful sense of community building in more than ways, and in ways that are very diverse, that represent very diverse, which we don't necessarily see represented either on Iranian TV or, you know, non-Iranian TVs outside. I think what's been inspiring for me is how people have, I hesitate to use this, but rallied around the flag quite literally with very different political and religious ideologies and beliefs. And it's been beautiful. Yeah.
We've seen certainly on social media, we see a lot of videos, and some of them provide really good insight. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit, but really interesting insight into the views of Iranians that are not reflected at all in mainstream media, not reflected in Arabic language media. I'm here in Jordan and I watch Al Jazeera Arabic a lot, and it's striking how absent those voices are. But one of the themes that we see in social media is that there are people who went out to protest against the government in January or at other times, but who are now, as you put it, rallying around the flag. That's a theme, but it's very hard to judge from looking at, you know, a social media clip, how, even if I'm not sure the word is even valid, representative that is. Iran is a large country with diverse political views, different economic classes, many different ethnicities and language groups, and so on. So I don't want to try to characterize Iranians as having one point of view. But is that a real phenomenon? How can you characterize the sense of how far does that feeling of national solidarity, patriotism, you could call it, cut across the society?
You know, Ali, I have a lot of folks who, I know a lot of folks who have not been necessarily sympathetic even to the state policies. They have been viciously critical of it, some rightly so, some caused by political confusions that are designed inherently within the hybrid warfare that has been launched. You know, it's the hybrid warfare, the sanctions, the covert and overt operations, the media warfare, they've all designed to really target the minds and create conditions for revolt. And it's been effective to some degree, to lesser degree that they hoped or thought, but it can work. And being in university, talking to many of students and young folks, what's been really interesting for me to observe is how many of these young people who had different positions before, they are reconsidering and repositioning themselves merely because of what they're seeing unfold. The years of Orientalism and internalized racism that some Iranians had internalized, especially, you know, the young generation maybe, and we saw elements of this outside in diaspora as well, although we can talk about how fascism characterizes that. But, you know, some had disassociated themselves or thought, you know, that Iranians can and would never have the same destiny or shared struggles with someone in Lebanon, someone in Palestine, someone in Iraq, because we want to be close, that the assimilation to whiteness, you know, the lifestyle, even how they show up, how they live, how they talk. What this war is making them realize, and many of them reposition and reconsider, is that no, we do have same interconnected struggles and destiny in this region as indigenous people in this region. And no, the bombs are not going to save us or bring us freedom, you know? And it's a moment, and moments like this historically and in present, there are moments of clarity. There are historical moments of clarity that really help that political confusion that I mentioned. It helps to clear the air. Okay, what is happening? We are being bombed. We are seeing many civilians and many, although I am critical of the distinction that some insist to make between civilians and armed forces, but yeah, many of them are waking up to the reality that no, until and unless we have imperial colonial project in our region, our destiny is shared with Palestinians. Our destiny is shared with everyone around us, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Lebanon to Oman. It's a regional collective identity that people are waking up to. And it's not to say that, you know, they're suddenly becoming hardline supporters of the Iranian states per se, but at least many are realizing that they are reconsidering and being aware how naive it is to think that you can win or advance any struggle domestically while you have an imperial force inflicting violence upon you or threatening your sovereignty. They're realizing that sovereignty is the precondition for any and all struggles inside to be advanced, from labor to gender equality to economic situation. We need to secure our sovereignty. And unless and until we do that, we cannot advance these struggles inside. And I think it's been incredibly helpful to then be able to talk to many of these, to be able to open conversations, you know. This has also been facilitated, I guess, or deepened by how they're seeing the leadership respond to this. You know, Iranian leadership has been at the front lines of this imposed war. They're giving their lives, from Sayyid Ali Khamenei, supreme leader, to the military commanders, that they're on the front lines protecting the Iranian people and their sovereignty. And that has also, I've heard from people who have told me, no, we were wrong to think that Ayatollah Khamenei may be hiding or maybe not willing to sacrifice. You know, it's been a moment of clarifying moment for many.
Since this is the Electronic Intifada, I want to focus a little bit more on what you mentioned about Palestine. Obviously, Palestine is part of a much bigger regional and global anti-colonial struggle, but it's also, Palestine is very present and we could say central in the strategy and thinking and rhetoric of the Islamic Republic and its leaders. And, you know, towards the end of the video clip we watched a few minutes ago, it's a longer clip than we showed. We only showed part of it. You noted that the memorial event was held on Tehran's Gaza Boulevard, and that the event also honored Palestinian children in Gaza who are victims of the ongoing genocide in Palestine. Now, outside Iran, I have heard this many times over the years. Western media and analysts, including Iranian diaspora analysts and activists, often claim that what they call the Iranian regime has taken up the issue of Palestine against the wishes of many Iranians and at the expense of Iranians. So there's this narrative that, oh, they're spending all this money on Gaza, on Palestine, on helping the resistance in Palestine while Iranians are in need. You've talked about sort of consciousness about Palestine in the context of this war, but expand on that a bit and react to that narrative I just gave you that you've probably heard as well.
Yes, I have. And I think, you know, what I tend to always criticize about how Iran seen as a site of protest in from Western perspectives, they're very enthusiastic and excited about every protest that takes place in a country like Iran, in a country that they would like to see a regime change in. You know, they get excited about any and all protests. And I remain, not all protests are equal. Just like we have fascists in any country, Iranians too are not immune to it. We have a lot of fascist Zionist Iranians outside of Iran, and we've seen it on the streets who are unapologetically, you know, showing up with the flag of Zionist entity. We don't try to justify or explain their positions as Iranians to defend our sovereignty. We fight them. That is, we fight fascists, we fight Zionists, just like how, you know, it's in 79, Iranian people fought with a regime that was working closely and collaborating with both the Zionist entity and the U.S. And so those groups have historically been present. They've been either funded or not funded, or they're in aligning themselves with fascist and Zionist forces. And a lot of this voice, which is amplified heavily by corporate media, that's where these narratives come from. And due to that, due to this heavy media campaign that have been imposed, that Iranians inside Iran have been the subject of for decades now, they try to impose this narrative that Iran is spending a lot of money at your expense instead of providing you with, you know, other services, social welfare services. It's at your expense that they're protecting Palestine. However, what this moment is helping people understand is that, number one, factually, that is incorrect. Iran is not spending a fraction. I think the last report, and please don't quote me on this, but Iran spends $10 million on advancing its defensive capabilities abroad and supporting the resistance forces. There are a few points here I want to make. Number one, this idea of Iran supporting Palestine, you know, although ideologically, and the stance of Iran against oppression is in its constitution. Iran's revolution was based, one of its core principles has been to defend the oppressed everywhere and anywhere in the world, from Cuba to Venezuela to Yemen to Palestine, regardless of their ethnicity, their religion. It's a principle of the Islamic Republic revolution based on 79. And more than it's being a material support, which it is, and it's not based on financial benefits the way that military-industrial complex or the U.S. operates with its proxies. The relationship has never been a proxy relationship, and that's what they fail to understand. Iran has empowered through both the principles of the revolution, but also materially providing the capacity and the knowledge, the indigenous knowledge that it has produced, for them to then develop their own capacity to advance liberation movements, anti-colonial liberation movements in the region. And Iran's strategic depth understood and was based on this, that unless we have a region free from Zionist colonial occupation, none of us in the region are safe. And this is another moment of clarity for Iranians who were critical of Iran's position towards Palestine or other resistance forces, that they're seeing the dream of Dubai, you know, seeing those advanced or developments or the towers or whatever they made of this modern development, that and they sold it to it. They're realizing that you can't rent your security. You cannot buy your security. You cannot protect your sovereignty through selling your oil. And that it is collapsing before their eyes that the fact that Iran did not choose the path of imported development through renting its sovereignty, through renting its resources, they're realizing how important the indigenous development rooted in the capacity of Iranians in Saipan and not dependent on others, how important it is for their livelihoods and how their lives literally depend on it. So that is helping them understand that Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen is all one battle against U.S. imperialism and the colonial violence. Ayatollah Khamenei had this beautiful point in last year in Eid al-Fitr prayers, where he said, if there is one proxy in this world that is the Zionist, that is the proxy of the United States, people are realizing that unless we have no proxies of colonial imperial forces in the region, we cannot advance our internal struggles, we cannot fight for how we want the government policies, economic policies, social policies, see change, unless we secure that and unless we protect the borders and the broader region from this violence, we cannot advance anything for ourselves.
Thank you. I want to talk about the war or the context of the war. Most U.S. aligned states, especially European and Arab regimes, have taken the position that Iran's retaliatory strikes against U.S. interests in countries in the region are illegal acts of aggression, while they fail even to mention, let alone condemn, the initial and ongoing U.S.-Israeli aggression against Iran. The U.N. Security Council even passed a resolution reflecting this one-sided position, and it passed thanks to the abstentions of Russia and China, who failed to veto it. Given your background in international law and critical legal studies, what's your response to that position? And what can you tell us about the legal justifications Iran is putting forward for retaliating against assets, whether military or U.S.-linked sites in states in the region?
Thanks for that. I think that's an important question to unpack. And I'll start with this. So there are two distinct categories here. There is uncontested, largely uncontested, and broad agreement among international lawyers, including many who are not even sympathetic to Iran as a political system, that the initial U.S.-Israeli attack constitute a manifest violation of Article 2.4 of the UN Charter, which prohibits the threat of use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. That's the foundation of international law post-war II, the protection of sovereignty, the principle of sovereignty of any nation. And so there are two exceptions to this rule. Number one, if there is UN security authorization, which was not the case in this aggression against Iran, or if a state is acting in self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter. That also has not been the case. Even neither of the Zionist entity or the US have claimed that they're invoking Article 51. And so the more contested question, however, is what you put forward here, is that the concerns around the legality of Iran's response, particularly its strikes against United States military bases located across the Persian Gulf within the Arab countries' territories. The first argument that they make to advance this, the illegality of the supposed illegality of Iran's action, is that U.S. bases located in the Persian Gulf are illegitimate targets for Iran because these installations may be uninvolved in the unlawful armed attack against Iran. The unlawful attack against Iran, and I am hesitant, and I think we should be aware that Iran is not retaliating anything. There is no legally justified way of retaliating under international law. Iran is acting in self-defense. Iran is acting defensive, not retaliating anything. It is defending itself. And so that's legally important. But yeah, so the U.S. bases and the target military objectives that Iran is targeting belonging to the attacking states that contributes to its military capacity, U.S. bases across the Persian Gulf constitute integral elements of the American military architecture in West Asia, providing logistical support, intelligence capabilities, force protections, and operational conditions. And also, the uninvolvement argument was made in early days, and ever since, there has been numerous evidence to prove otherwise, that they are, in fact, involved actively in the attacks that are being conducted against Iranian sovereignty. That's number one. Number two, the second claim that is advanced is the claim that the Persian Gulf states allegedly did not permit their territory to be used for attacks against Iran. International law has long recognized that the use of a force originating from the territory of a third state may engage that state's legal responsibility. The definition of aggression adopted by UN General Assembly resolution, which is non-binding, but over a state practice, it can be customary international law and therefore binding, recalls that the action of a state in allowing its territory, which it has placed at the disposal of another state to be used by that other state for perpetuating an act of aggression against the third state, is an act of aggression. Iran, however, despite this legal base, Iran is refraining from claiming that it is at war or it sees these attacks as acts of aggressions on behalf of these Arab states. Iran is not declaring war on them. It is merely insisting that it is targeting only the military bases and military objectives that are situated within these, that belongs to the U.S. or it benefits the U.S. Military aggression against Iran. But I think Iran can also further invoke the unwilling and unable doctrine for its defensive strike against the U.S. military installation in the Persian Gulf. This doctrine, which has emerged through extensive state practice as an interpretation of the inherent right of self-defense under Article 51, permits a victim state to take proportionate defensive action within the territory of another state when the territorial state is either unwilling or unable to prevent its territory from being used as a launch pad for armed attacks. The United States itself has repeatedly used this doctrine or relied upon it to justify operations in Pakistan, in Syria, in Yemen, in Somalia, the UK. We've seen the UK also invoke this in counterterrorism context and operations. We've seen Turkey consistently using it as a ground for operations against PKK in Iraq. So it's been established a state practice, the unwilling and unable doctrine. Applying this to the framework of Iran, Iran's defensive operation satisfies each element of the unwilling and unable doctrine. Iran has repeatedly demanded the host states to suppress and stop the use of their territory for attacks against Iranian sovereignty, both since the start of U.S.-Israeli aggression and in the period preceding the initial attack. The sustained pattern of hostile and aggressive operations emanating from these bases in the region, including the Al-Udeid base in Qatar, including which operates as the biggest military base of the U.S. in West Asia, we've seen it time and again for Iran to request for them to stop it, and they've proven either unwilling or unable to do it. So the requirement that a victim states allow reasonable time for response has also been met. What is very important here is that the unwilling and unable doctrine can be invoked when there is a non-state actor present in a third state territory and launches attack against another state. What is very significant here is that we go back and we recognize Iran's legal framework here to make this work. So the characterization of the Iran's actions within the doctrine of unwilling and unable should be understood within the framework of Iran's domestic legal order, which has formally designated both the United States military and the Israeli military as terrorist organizations. Consequently, from the perspective of the Islamic Republic, as far as Iran is concerned, the armed attacks conducted against its territory from bases in neighboring countries constitute acts of aggression by terrorist organizations that are operating from third estate territory. This engages the full scope of unwilling and unable doctrine, as the host states have failed to prevent their territory from being used as a launchpad for what Iran lawfully considers terrorist organizations, terrorist operations against its territory. And notably, no states in the region has reported, nor has it credible evidence emerged to support that Iran has deliberately targeted a civilian object or any assets or any bases that belong to the hosting state. Iran has been insisting and very intentional satisfying the proportionality principle within international humanitarian law that distincts the military objects from civilian objects. So I think these are some of the legal bases that needs to be discussed when we talk about Iran's action.
I've heard it noted, and I think it is the case from my own observations, that, for example, when Iran attacked some of the oil and gas infrastructure following the U.S.-Israeli attacks on the South Pars gas field, Iran said that it was only attacking installations that had U.S. ownership or U.S. interests. I didn't check all of them, but the Qatari installation, I think, which is one of the most significant that Iran struck, the Ras Laffan field, both ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips, which are U.S. companies, have major roles in joint ventures there. Now, that's not the point I wanted to point to, but Iran would certainly claim that that's a justification for targeting those facilities. But what I wanted to point to is that, in contrast to the United States and Israel, Iran gave at least several hours of advance notice of those strikes so that any workers or any people living nearby would have an opportunity to leave those areas, whereas I don't think people living in proximity or the workers, the Iranian facilities that were attacked, got those warnings. And of course, there was the attack on the oil storage tanks near Tehran near the start of the war that, you know, potentially poisoned millions of residents of the city. Any thoughts about those issues?
Yeah, I think what we just described reinforces is that Iran is waging its decolonial war lawfully. As much as the entire structure of international law, including international humanitarian law, has been to reproduce imperial violence, have been to facilitate imperial violence, we know that there is no mechanism, real mechanism of accountability of genociders in the current international legal system. And yet, Iran is conducting its defensive work legally. What I want to mention here as well is that as Iran is waging this war lawfully and is insisting on doing so lawfully, something else is also happening, and that is the emergence. And we've been talking about a lot of legal scholars and critical legal scholars have been thinking about the collapse of the international order starting, you know, ever since October 7th. And that was, I keep repeating that, that was the gift of Palestine to the world that forced the world to unmask the facade of a human rights, international legal system, the rule of law, all of this. And I think now that we have seen this system collapse, Iran is also forging, and this is what we need to do in the global south. We've seen China taking steps towards this as well, forging an alternative legal system, a new legal, international legal system. And one example of this is the legal regime that Iran is now enforcing upon the Strait of Hormuz. And that international law has always been, you know, backed, but there's international law is toothless unless there is a state power to back it, or whoever is a more powerful state, it can enforce its interpretation of international law. That's how international law operates. And now, with the shifting power in global dynamic, Iran is also exercising its power through legally articulated regimes and creating these new legal regimes. And I think this is something that we should be talking about broadly in how we want to envision the world after the collapse of international legal order as it shaped after the Second World War. How are we going to define accountability mechanisms? Because it's not going to come out of New York. It's not going to come out of Hague. It's not going to be in Geneva. It's going to be in Gaza. It's going to be in Yemen. And it's going to be in Tehran. And I think it's going to be the indigenous knowledge production and indigenous lawyers and to these lands and those who lived under the violence of imperialism that was not only allowed, but facilitated and reproduced through international law that are we'll be designing and we'll be talking about it. And we're seeing an example of this in the Strait of Hormuz and how Iran is doing this new legal regime.
It is definitely history, including legal history, in the making. And especially after the US and the imperial powers dismantled, however imperfect it was, there was some kind of system and they've taken it apart. Dr. Helia, we have just a few minutes left. And I want to ask you just to shift a little bit. When I introduced you, I mentioned that last year you were fired from Yale University in the United States for speaking about Palestine. Do you want to give us just a brief picture of what happened? And given your experience in the United States and during this ongoing war, now that you're in Iran, what do you think people outside Iran, especially in the West, are still not understanding about how U.S. and Israeli power operate in their own societies, as well as in the region through warplanes and bombs? And what meaningful solidarity with people in Iran and Palestine, what should that actually look like now?
So I was expelled from Yale Law School and the LPE project, which claimed to be the left voice within legal academia in the U.S., as majority of those folks who upheld those perspectives remained silent. And it happened as the naked fascism was being and repression was being unleashed upon academic universities. And I think that was important for the United States to do, and it worked. It was very effective in how people were intimidated and silenced in campuses and outside because of the vicious and ruthless repression of voices, whether it was through expulsion, taking away your jobs, taking away your salaries, taking away your visas, your status, people with precarious visa status, including myself. And so, I was one of those, and I was unapologetic and loud, has always been, about my positions against the genocide in Gaza and the broader liberation struggle in West Asia. And my views and perspectives on Iran has always also been very controversial for many, including many secular Western folks and circles within the United States. I wasn't silenced. I was expelled. My visa was taken away, so I relocated to Canada, but I eventually decided that it is important for me in this historical moment to be in Iran. I think we all of us were expecting that the previous, the 12-day war was a pause. And that we were going to, and as we know now, this is going to be a struggle that we're gonna continue for years until the complete dismantling of the Zionist entity. So I thought it was important for me to relocate physically after about 17 years. I've never lived in Iran as an adult. This is my first time here living. And I thought, as much as the region and Iran is doing a lot of work militarily and materially to decolonize the world and the region of West Asia, it was equally important for me as an academic to also relocate knowledge production and be amongst Iranians inside to start producing knowledge so that we don't understand ourselves through the lens of scholars and academia that are situated within the heart of, within the belly of the beast, which also means that they are consciously or unconsciously bound by the limits of those institutions that are invested in genocide. It became important for me to choose to be in institutions that are not only not invested in genocide, but are actively opposed to it. It was an important decision for me to make, both personally, politically, and otherwise and beyond. And I think being here has made me aware of a lot of things I missed in terms of, you know, being amongst my people, seeing this revolutionary society and be amongst it has been an honor. It also helps you in terms of knowledge production, because they operate. It's important that being in institutions that are not only not invested in genocide, but are actively against it. By no means am I saying it's a there are no issues or complexities or differences or different politics or dynamics as in any other country. Iran is incredibly plural and diverse, including in academic spaces. And I think it's a beauty of it. We have a lot of disagreements in our departments or in our academic discussions, and I love it. And
probably more than in the U.S. at this point, given the enforcement of
what I've been saying, Ali, that I have had much more freedom in expressing myself, and I've seen others who are viciously against the Islamic Republic of Iran operating in universities in important positions as like deans of the faculties or professors, expressing themselves and their views and holding conferences. And we couldn't do that in the US or in Canada. It's been a very different experience being able to express myself, not being suppressed and not feel threatened to stand for what I believe in.
In closing, what do you think people, you know, many people who are watching this, we hope people all over the world will be watching it, but many people will be watching from Europe and North America, where there is, you know, opposition to the war, at least according to opinion polls. I don't think we certainly haven't seen the kind of mass rallies that we're seeing in Iran every night, but that opposition is likely to grow. What do you think people need to know? What could solidarity look like? I'm not saying you have all the answers, but if you have any thoughts on that you'd like to share, I would love to hear that.
I'm a little bitter about this question and the whole solidarity movement, especially in the West, I have to admit. And it's because of a decade of involvement in different movements and working in them, and especially since October 7th. I think we should measure the success of any movement by its efficacy, by how are you inflicting change? How are you changing, you know, of what you're resisting and what you're opposing? And we haven't seen much. We haven't seen much from the labor movement in the United States. We haven't seen much from anti-war movements. We witnessed a live stream genocide with massive millions of people across Turtle Island, across Europe, and with no change in their government's policies. So I think there should be serious reflection, self-critique from within these movements to assess and evaluate how they are operating, how they are organizing, and how there is some, how much longer do we want to do education? How much at the expense of our lives, at the expense of our people and the global south and the broader global south? I think there has been enough education and enough, building up to it. And I think there needs to be serious critical reflection on how to escalate and how to advance the struggles from the belly of the beast. And it's a historical responsibility on anyone who is, and a lot of those people I consider my dear comrades who've been incredibly principled and comradely in all of it, and they've sustained me, you know, emotionally and otherwise. And so I think this is the first point I wanted to make. And the second is that the only principled solidarity with Iranians right now, for those who are in the belly of the beast, is to oppose any and all imperial violence against Iran by those governments. It's not their concern. So what Iran does and how we advance our human rights struggles, women's rights struggles, labor issues, It's not their concerns. Iranians have proven time and again that they have agency and they have the power, unlike political subjects in the West that are often, incapable of inflicting that change. Iranians have proven time and again that they are more than capable to materialize the changes that they want to see through different means of organizing. The second point I wanted to make is that it is important to recognize the legitimate rights of the Iranian nations and liberation movements in the region to exercise their right to self-determination and nationhood through any means necessary, including their internationally recognized rights to defend themselves and their sovereignty through armed resistance. So legitimizing the armed forces that are defending the sovereignty of Iran and the broader region, defending them, legitimizing them. So it's not only about being anti-war, but it is also being pro-sovereignty, pro-self-determination and nationhood of people who are under colonial and imperial aggression by the United States. And also sanctions. Sanctions are not only economic warfare that has been waged as part of the broader hybrid warfare against Iran, but it is deeply intertwined with class, the reshaping of formation of class in Iran. Those who are concerned with labor rights, those who are concerned with women's rights, these are sanctions have been disproportionately impacting these sectors of Iran society, as it is from Cuba to Venezuela to Iraq to other nations that have been the target of these regimes. And so, I think articulating a principled anti-imperialist and meaningful solidarity has to be rooted in opposing imperial and colonial aggressions that are being inflicted by the governments that are, those who reside in the belly of the beast pay taxes to.
It's interesting. I've been, unfortunately, observing, writing about, protesting against American wars of imperialism for 30 years. And going back to the 1990s, and I would have to say that this war, I'm talking about from my narrow perspective, I can't speak for the whole world, seems to me to have the least support of any war at its starting point. That's confirmed by opinion polls to the extent that those tell us anything. But it's also clear to me from social media, which, of course, one always has to be very critical when reading social media, because it's very easy to distort our view of the world. Nonetheless, it is the major public forum now. And it's striking to me when you see public officials, Western public officials, put statements on social media condemning Iran's self-defense or siding with Israel. It's their own citizens who are replying, thousands of them, and saying, you don't speak for us, and this is outrageous, and what about this? And, that you can see something visceral changing there. And I think that independent media and just individuals like yourself have played a key role in that. Dr. Helia Dutari, thank you so much for your time and for all of the incredible insight and information you've given us. And I hope you'll join us again.
Inshallah. I really appreciate you having me and for the incredible work that you've been doing.
Thank you.
That was Helia Dutahi, an Iranian scholar of international law and political economy at the University of Tehran. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Live music fans, get ready. Spring Reverb returns for its fifth edition May 28th through the 31st in downtown Kingston, Ontario, and CFRC is thrilled to be part of the action. Over 4 days, you can catch live music panels, workshops, and see what makes the Kingston music scene tick. Get ready for acts like Bedouin Soundclash, The Dirty Nil, Hot Garbage, By Divine Rights, Slaves of Spanky, Pony Girl, Tanya Iyer, Golden Feather, and so much more. Also, make sure to check out all the free panels, workshops, a merch market, and the first ever Catarocway Punk Rock Flea Market. For more information on the lineup and tickets, visit kppconcerts.com or Spring Reverb YGK on socials. See you there.